Republicans to wake up. The Republican Party right now is not led by conservatives. There's a population out there that has to be told the truth. We have to. Do it live!
Now, from the left coast, it's another podcast edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Peter B. is curious, opinionated, and relentless in pursuit of the truth like a honeybee drawn to pollen. He's an independent progressive, ready to sting Republicans and Democrats alike when they deserve it. After years in commercial radio, Peter B. welcomes you to this audio adventure in news and politics with no corporate filter. Listeners support this program, and you can help at peterbcollins.com. Here's your humble host, Peter B.
Thank you for downloading the very latest from peterbcollins.com. This program is supported by listeners who subscribe. People like Doreen Marshall, Greg McArdle, Jeffrey Stewart, Nancy Kilgore, and I haven't mentioned Terry Pelio in ages. If you're not a subscriber, you can change that. All the details are at the links right under my picture on the homepage at peterbcollins.com. In the second segment of today's podcast, Jeff Halper returns to our program. He's an American Jew who lives in Israel and started the project that opposes demolition of Palestinian homes. We're going to see if he thinks a one-state solution might be the only way forward for the Palestinians, and talk about a number of other issues, too. That's coming up. Right now, I'm pleased to welcome Frank Viviano to our program. He's here with me in the secret studio today. Frank worked for many years at the San Francisco Chronicle and somehow got the plum assignment to be based in Paris as their European correspondent for many years. He has covered all sorts of stories in the Middle East, and I think you're now comfortably retired. Do you describe it that way, Frank?
Well, I don't know if retirement is really comfortable, Peter. I'm a journalist through and through. I miss the daily reporting, and I still do magazine work and newspaper work when there's a good story.
Yeah.
But I'm living in a very comfortable town in western Tuscany, yeah.
Yeah. Oh, well, for many people, that is a dream life. Does it live up to people's sense of that, the fantasy?
It would be hard to find a place where the quality of daily life in terms of relations with neighbors, in terms of the food that's available, in terms of the sheer beauty of the landscape, is better than it is in rural Italy. Yeah, it's a wonderful place to live.
Well, interesting. I just want to have a wide-ranging conversation with you and get your thoughts as a well-informed person who spends a lot of your time outside the country, about a little over half the year, you tell me. And let me start with what the current perception of the United States is with Barack Obama as president. Have we recovered from the wounds inflicted by the Bush administration, the characterization of old Europe, and the way that Europe was often muscled into line by Bush and his cohorts?
I think, yes, that's certainly true for two reasons. One is that, if anything, the support for Obama and the admiration of Obama and a kind of jealousy over what Obama represented in terms of America's progress on the racial front, diversity in general, that admiration was even greater in Europe when he was elected. And it remains extremely high, not only in Europe, but I don't know if you followed, I think most Americans did actually, President Obama's recent visit to Israel. He wowed people there. So first there's the Obama phenomenon, Obama mania, which remains pretty feverish in Europe. Second, there's the fact that although Americans themselves may feel that the recession that began in the last year of the Bush administration has yet to be fully eased, the progress that we've made getting out of that hole is far greater than the Europeans have made. Even Germany is going backwards now. And they're beginning to ask themselves what we did differently, because obviously the medicine they've been taking is not working.
Mm-hmm. I certainly want to come back to austerity. But staying with Obama for a moment, what is the perception in particular of the war in Afghanistan and the expanded use of drones in Pakistan and Yemen, elsewhere? Obama has been much more of a militarist than many people like me who supported him thought. And I'm curious how that plays in Europe. The coalition of the billing that we put together for Iraq has largely evaporated. We still call the occupying force in Afghanistan NATO, but that's window dressing. How do Europeans feel about America's internationalist posture?
I think that there is an audible European reply to that, and then there's a more honest reply below the surface. The audible reply would agree with your analysis, certainly, and if you look at the mainstream press, it's full of criticism of American policy in Afghanistan, and they run many articles on the phenomenon of the drone and civilian casualties. This doesn't impinge very much on the perception of Obama himself, because he shares some of the Reagan Teflon presidency qualities. His personality and his metaphorical importance as a representative of diversity in a Europe that is itself much more diverse now than it was a generation ago.
Mm-hmm.
For better or worse, Europeans do distinguish between Obama, the leader, Obama, the man, and Obama, the metaphor for diversity, and his policies.
Mm-hmm.
The second part of the equation has to do with those policies themselves. The Europeans don't want to be involved in Afghanistan, but because of their own domestic tensions today, on a certain level, all of them would like to see the United States somehow or another staunch the tide of Islamic fundamentalism,
mm-hmm.
because they feel much, much more on the front line of that struggle than Americans do.
Yeah. And that is an interesting issue, because the dynamics in Europe have changed. Nationalism is on the rise in individual countries, despite the effort to build the European Union. And much of that relates to the presence of non-citizens. And because many of them are Islamic, and there's a mix, some of them are Arab Islamic and others are African Islamic, it is a real challenge to the kind of cultural preservation techniques that have been in place in many European countries for a long time. So talk a little bit about those tensions and how they're playing out, particularly in France and Italy.
Just a generation or a generation and a half ago, issues having to do with race and immigration and diversity were American issues, and that's the way they were perceived by the Europeans, which is one reason that the Europeans found it very comfortable, very easy to be critical of American failings in those spheres. Today, the percentage of non-French in France is probably higher than the percentage of, for example, African Americans in the United States, and certainly higher than the percentage of immigrants in the United States. This is true as well, increasingly in Great Britain, it's true in Germany, it's true in Holland, it's true in Denmark, and it will become true very soon in Spain and Italy, because the numbers of immigrants are rising so quickly there. So this is a new issue for them, and they're finding that that what they didn't anticipate is that they would become defensive about the maintenance of their own culture. Europeans have always derived not merely strength from the integrity and continuity of their ancient cultures, but also a certain self-satisfaction that they were impregnable. When this gets out of hand, of course, you have the rise of nationalism. Nationalism can rise out of a feeling that your culture is too strong and should probably rule over surrounding cultures, or it can rise out of a feeling that the strength and integrity of your culture is threatened. Mm-hmm. Today they feel threatened, and they don't quite know what to do about it. This, again, affects their attitude toward Obama, who seems to them to represent an American solution to the problem, which is a post-racial, post-immigrant solution. But at this point, it's inconceivable that the son of an African immigrant could become president of France, for example, mm-hmm. even though there are infinitely more African immigrants in France than there are in the United States.
And there are economic drivers, too, because of demographics, all right? You told me before we started recording that in schools in France, Germany, Italy, the populations are largely non-natives. And that while this is seen as a problem, the economic driver is that they need the workforce because of low birth rates of the indigenous citizens, and the need to support the superstructure of these large welfare states.
Yeah. Yeah, the elephant in every room in Europe today is immigration. And that metaphor, the elephant in the room, is particularly appropriate because on one hand, they can't avoid looking at it. On the other hand, they don't want to look too closely because it scares the hell out of them.
Mm-hmm.
And it scares them in part because it's a reminder of the fact that they themselves stopped having children two generations ago. I mean, we think of Italy, for example, as being a culture that's focused on family.
Mm-hmm.
The Italians now have the lowest birth rate in the world.
How can that be? It's a Catholic country and contraception is banned.
Well, contraception is not banned anymore. The ban ended in the 1980s, if I'm not mistaken. And in any case, the Italians were always able to acquire contraceptive devices and pills from neighboring countries. You know, all explanations for the collapsing birth rate are speculative. I mean, we have the overall, almost universal explanation that with rising wealth, you always have a drop in the fertility rate. But within that generalization, there are always differences between various countries based on religion, based on history, based on culture and social norms. All that seems to have broken down now. I mean, in point of fact, the two countries with the lowest birth rates are Spain and Italy in Western Europe, and those are countries that are in the South, intensely Roman Catholic, and have longstanding family traditions. So, you know, you have to look elsewhere. You have to speculate in other ways. And wherever your speculation carries you, the factual result is inescapable. Europe as a whole is nowhere near replacement rate in its fertility. It's way, way below ZPG. This means at the same time that it's aging very, very rapidly, which is something they also don't want to look at, because you put these two things together, a shrinking workforce of young people and a larger and larger number of elderly people who need medical care and housing, and it leads you to wonder who's going to pay for it.
Mm-hmm.
And when they first began noticing this problem, the shrinking labor force, roughly 25 or 30 years ago, they opened the doors to immigration. And the immigration came largely from North Africa, and then after a time, West Africa. They were from populations that were almost exclusively Muslim. And then there were also large numbers of people coming in from the Middle East, beginning with the first Gulf War and continuing today. And yet another group of Muslims coming from former Yugoslavia. And the end result is that the elephant in the room is fearful not only because it's the other, but it's the other that represents what is, in a certain respect, the longest-running, sometimes hot and sometimes cold war in history, and that is the confrontation between Western European Christianity and Middle Eastern or North African Islamic cultures that began in the 7th or 8th century and, in a certain regard, continues today.
Yeah. Frank, turning now to the European Union, and the crisis, the financial crisis that they continue to deal with. The most recent flare-up, of course, is Cyprus, where the banking sector was 8 times bigger than the GDP of the nation. They heavily invested in bonds from Greece. And the backstory on that, from my point of view, is that Goldman Sachs worked with the Greek government to use Enron-style accounting to hide their pension and other liabilities. And then when they had to bring those onto the books, it created this, very clear crisis. The impact on Cyprus most recently has seen the remarkable tactic of bankers, in this case central bankers, ordering that the sanctity of bank accounts essentially be violated so that they could reach in there and grab money, particularly from Russian depositors who were hiding those funds in the banking haven of Cyprus. And I find this interesting in a number of ways. First of all, will the euro as a currency and the community survive this? And secondly, is there any anything left of the integrity of the banking system when, in order to pay debt that was created by investment bankers over here, we have essentially state banks raiding the accounts of bank holders in Cyprus? And this all seems to be by and for the rich at the expense of the little people.
Well, I think it's even seedier than that, Peter. Who are the Russians who are responsible for the fact that the banking sector is 8 times the size of the GDP in Cyprus? They're probably people who invested in Russia itself heavily in resource theft. And so Cyprus presents us with the most interesting, if that's the right word, or perhaps the most menacing example of how Europe's crisis extends way beyond Europe's own shores. We were worried up until now, for example, about the possibility of a default in Greece affecting the banking system in France because the French had bought so many Greek bonds, but that was within the boundaries of the European Union. But little Cyprus is demonstrating that this could become a geopolitical problem with strategic consequences, very, very dire consequences, because, you know, put in its simplest form, the people who are now threatened by the effort to save the euro by saving Cyprus are the close buddies and accomplices of Vladimir Putin.
Mm-hmm.
And Putin has the capacity to turn off the gas that goes into Western Europe. Most natural gas in Western Europe comes from Russia. And so if you apply old-fashioned domino theory to this, the dominoes could be carrying us to a major confrontation between West and a revived and once again self-assertive Russia, with consequences that no one can really foresee.
Mm-hmm. I recall being in England at the time of the Maastricht Treaty and reading an editorial in the Times about why Britain should not adopt the euro as its currency. And they said, well, who wants to be, on the receiving end of Italy's failure to balance its budgets and the wild ride that the lira had over the years? And, you know, that still sits with me as a fairly wise caution on the part of the UK. Is there hope to keep the euro alive, and is it worth it? Is the system working overall to the benefit of average citizens in the European community?
I think that the resolution of this crisis is going to carry Europe to the point where it recognizes that it has only two alternatives. One alternative is going to be to give up on the euro or to let it shrink down to a basic number of countries that have solvent central banks and can deal with a common currency. But that's going to be at the expense of the larger European Union. The other alternative is precisely the opposite. If this crisis demonstrates anything, it's that you actually cannot have a union without a single currency run by an agency that speaks for all of European financial institutions. If you have 28 countries in the European Union with 28 different treasuries and 28 different systems of laws and 28 sets of people pulling the strings, it's simply not going to work. So it really is true that I think the European Union, the very future of the European Union, is at stake here. I have to say, with respect to the Brits, though, there's a certain amount of hypocrisy involved, because the Brits, they want the full benefits of the European Union. Europe is by far their greatest trading partner, but they don't want to pay the price for that. Mm-hmm. I mean, they want to opt out of almost everything that they find uncomfortable, and that's not a feasible stance either.
Mm-hmm. What is your evaluation of the austerity moves that have been imposed increasingly in European countries? And let's start with Italy, where you live. From these shores, austerity seems to be short-sighted and driven by a phony notion that you can cut your way into prosperity. And in a moment, I'll try to apply it to the United States and get your thoughts as a largely expatriate on how it may work here. But how are people responding, particularly in Italy, to the austerity moves?
Well, not well, because since the mid-1950s, Europe as a whole has been on an almost unbroken run of prosperity. And so you have two generations of Europeans who have never known anything, particularly Europeans in the solid part of Western Europe. I'm not including, say, the more recent members of the European Union. Let's say the initial 11 countries. Two generations have known essentially nothing but prosperity. And all of the reasoning in the world, all of the analysis in the world that demonstrates that there were mistakes made, that perhaps they were living beyond their means, these aren't convincing to people. I mean, that the psychology of mass political culture is that people aren't analytical about it. They want to continue receiving the benefits of citizenship, and if you take away those benefits, they're going to respond politically. And so very, very much today, the economic crisis has become a political crisis. There's not a single European leader now, with the exception of Angela Merkel, who isn't likely to fall from one day to the next. Mm-hmm. There's no solid central government left standing in Western Europe. And on the matter of coming up with a common policy to address the problem, there is a fundamental dilemma, which is that the economic crisis is different in every country. So, for example, the Italians have no export problem. The Italians have no mortgage problem. Italians never take mortgages out to buy houses. The banks don't give them mortgages. They don't ask for them. Italians save their money and they buy houses for cash, believe it or not. Hmm. It's a pretty primitive system, but it's a system that still, by and large, applies there. The Italian export sector, until quite recently, was almost as strong as Germany's. I mean, not as powerful worldwide, but they don't really have a really serious deficit.
Trade deficit.
Mm-hmm. If you shift, however, to Spain, you find that their mortgage problem is surpassed only by the one in Great Britain. Great Britain has the highest per household indebtedness of any country on the planet, much, much higher than the United States. Their banking system is in serious trouble as a result. So how do you come up with a common policy? See, in the old days, this didn't bother anybody, because as you've pointed out, when the Italians had problems one way or another with fiscal integrity, they just devalued the lira.
Yeah.
You know, well, you can't do that anymore. And you can't do it in part because there's not one crisis in the European Union. There are 27 different crises with very, very different characteristics. And second, even though you have a common currency among about half of the members of the EU, it's not subject to a single authority that can make determinations about interest rates or anything else. So they're in a bind.
Mm-hmm. And in Italy, you've been waiting to see a government form for, what, about 60 days now?
40 days.
40 days, okay. And why is Bunga Bunga Silvio Berlusconi still in the picture at all? Hasn't he been sentenced to jail?
If you talk to 10 Italians, they'll have 10 theories about it. He's not in jail.
But he was sentenced to jail, right?
Silvio Berlusconi has been indicted on criminal charges 17 times. And he's been found innocent twice.
Mm-hmm.
The other 15 times, either he was found guilty but then never required to serve his sentence. He's been sentenced even recently.
Yeah.
Not required to serve because as prime minister, he had immunity.
Mm-hmm.
Or, in a peculiarly Italian phenomenon in the judicial sphere, the statute of limitations clock continues running in Italy, even during an appeal in a court case. So if you are wealthy enough to have the kind of attorneys who can keep the appeal process spinning forward, eventually the clock runs out and the charges are dropped because you haven't been fully convicted in time. And second, Berlusconi is an extraordinarily clever politician. I'll tell you a little story that seemed mostly to escape the American press. About 4 years ago, if I remember correctly, Berlusconi was giving a speech in Milan, and a fellow who had walked out that morning from a psychiatric clinic, he managed to find an open door and walked out, threw a statue of the Milan Cathedral at Berlusconi and hit him in the forehead and face and broke his nose. And he was carted off to the hospital. He had to have some teeth replaced and his nose fixed. And he was in the hospital for 2 weeks. And for those 2 weeks, he was essentially exempt from criticism by the opposition because everyone had to feel sorry for him. And so halfway into the second week, he issued an executive order saying that any Italian who had put undeclared income into a Swiss bank could return it to Italy within the next 5 days, and there would be no prosecution, and they would simply have to pay a 4% tax fee on it. Now, we're talking about a country which, at least on paper, has individual taxes for large amounts of money in the area of 50%.
Mm-hmm.
So 4% was a pretty good deal. So within 5 days, $217 billion worth of investments left Swiss banks and were returned to Italy and went into Italian banks. Now, if you ask yourself a simple question, who might have put over $200 billion worth of undeclared money into Swiss banks and who now had managed to have it laundered at a price of only 4%?
Mm-hmm.
The M word comes to mind instantly. So effectively, Berlusconi, who by some accounts got his start because of ties to organized crime and has continued to have very, very suspicious henchmen around him ever since, some of whom have wound up in prison and others have wound up dead, by the way, Silvio Berlusconi managed to launder $200 billion worth of mafia money, probably mostly mafia money, in just a few days with a 4% fee, commission fee, let's call it.
Yeah.
Italians look at that, and rather than being staggered at the transparency of what's happened, they're amused by it. I mean, it's a very, very difficult dynamic to understand or explain to people outside of Italy. Despite the sex scandals, the financial scandals, despite the fact that Italy is the only country in Western Europe that has essentially had no real economic growth over the last 10 years, Silvio Berlusconi retains appeal.
Yeah.
And the chances are now that after 40 days of unsuccessfully trying to form a government after what was a stalemate national election, that they'll call new elections, and this time Berlusconi will be back in power.
And immune.
And immune, once again. The only legislation he ever really pushes for is legislation to protect his own interests.
Mm-hmm. Now, let me ask you about a case in Italy that we've covered quite in some detail here, and that is the case of Abu Omar in Milan. He was a low-level terrorist. He was raising money for jihadists, and the CIA was working with the secret police in Italy to monitor this guy, and then the CIA went off. Kind of freelance, didn't tell the Italian counterparts. They snatched this guy in broad daylight from the streets of Milan, and the trail that they left for professional spies was comical, all right? Cell phones, hotel bills where agents with secret identities used their real names in order to collect bonus miles and things like that, staying in $700 a night hotels. There was the trail to Aviano, where they renditioned Abu Omar to Egypt for torture under Omar Suleiman. At any rate, 26 Americans were convicted in absentia, including the CIA station chief at the time in Rome. And last week, an Italian judge pardoned one of those 26. I don't know all the details.
He was the only one who wasn't actually in the CIA.
He was running the Aviano Air Base, right?
Yeah, he was straightforward military. Yeah.
What are the implications of that case in Italy? Because it's been completely stonewalled in the United States. We don't collaborate with the Italians to surrender these people who've been convicted. And there was a recent report that there are 54 nations that collaborated in our rendition program, either by allowing us to snatch people from their streets or stash them in their prisons or, some cases, just overfly their airspace. Is there any outrage at the Bigfoot of the United States and the almost Keystone Cops antics of the CIA in this episode in Milan?
Not only Italians, but Europeans in general sort of want it two ways when it comes to the CIA. On one hand, they want to believe the CIA is responsible for almost every plot on the planet, and and particularly in the south of Europe, they're given to conspiracy theories anyhow. But at the same time, they're amused by the Keystone Cops aspect of they regard Americans at one and the same time as being capable of having a desire to rule the world, but also being utterly incompetent. And the CIA does everything possible to convince them that they're right. Both counts.
Well, this is like a spaghetti western Milanese.
It is. I could be wrong about this, and you could check on it, but I don't believe that the Italian government has actually filed formal extradition requests on these convicted CIA agents. I think that from the Italian point of view, it was necessary to make noise because they felt when he was grabbed off the street and the story was broken that their national sovereignty had been violated. At the same time, the last thing they want is for the CIA to stop being a distant front, protecting them against the menace of Islamic fundamentalism at the expense of the American taxpayers. So it's like so much in Italy, it has more to do with theater than it really does with strategic issues or questions. Mm-hmm. It's the Italians are pretty cunning about appearing to be on board with everybody. You know, Berlusconi is a case in point. He was the closest personal friend among statesmen at one and the same time to both George Bush and Gaddafi. He's a close personal friend in vacations with Putin. He's close to everybody. He's everybody's buddy. Mm-hmm. You know, from the Italian...
Well, he's got the girls. Come on.
Yeah, he's got the bunga bunga.
Frank, I wanted to circle back to austerity because many people, myself included, are outraged that President Obama, since the summer of 2011, has been repeatedly negotiating with himself, saying to the Republicans, please help me cut Social Security. And now it's in the form of this chain CPI, which slows the rate of increase. Robert Reich wrote a great piece showing that one of the big drivers for retirees in their increased cost of living is healthcare costs, which go up much faster than the consumer price index. And so that if we lock down the rate of increase in benefits, the squeeze will actually cause people to make choices that could cost them their lives ultimately. So I find this to be a major transgression, and I don't need to reiterate for you, but I will, that cutting Social Security will not reduce the annual deficit. It will not do anything about the long-term structural deficit. And so progressives are working to mobilize, but it appears the president is intent on doing this. Is this like for a European audience to show that we can cut entitlements, welfare benefits?
No European country would. There's no mainstream politician in Europe anywhere who would propose such a thing. And it's a puzzle to Europeans how ordinary Americans could support a party, because, of course, it's the Republicans, by and large, who want to cut such benefits. It's inconceivable to them that ordinary people could so consistently vote against their own interest. And I have to admit that it's pretty hard for me to understand it as well. Now, Paul Krugman this morning, interestingly enough, because no one's more opposed to austerity measures than Krugman, he said that he doesn't think that Obama means it. Obama wants to bring the Republicans back out from their hidey holes and expose them as, because you see, the first response of Boehner was to say that,
well, he dismissed it.
Yeah, he dismissed it. I mean, mm-hmm. he's not, because Obama,
Which is why I describe the president as negotiating with himself. If he had deal,
which is the mistake he made in the first administration, in the first term.
Absolutely. Yeah. If he had some deal on the table and needed a sweetener or even something spicy to pull it all together, it would be understandable. But here he is throwing this out, and I just think that it really does cause waves of panic in Americans to think that a Democratic president would cough this up voluntarily.
It is a really, I think all of us are asking what's the real story here? Because he's returned to a kind of packaging that he so unsuccessfully tried to present the Republicans in the first term, and it never got him anywhere. That's why Krugman, for example, has concluded that this is a feint, that he wants to bring them back out in the open and hang on them once again, because what they're saying is no tax increases, but yes, in fact, we want to cut the social benefits even more. And then he withdraws a pact because they're not interested. Strategically, I don't think that's a very wise thing to be doing. However, on the issue of austerity, a very fascinating thing has happened in the last week, which is that after 12 years of urging on the part of Krugman, the Japanese have effectively announced that they're undertaking a Paul Krugman program. The Central Bank of Japan is going to now implement a policy by long-term bond purchase, aggressive bond purchasing by the central government, which has a lot of money at its disposal. Japan has the second largest foreign reserves in the world after China.
And a high savings rate.
And they are setting out to double the money supply in 2 years, which is an astounding thing to do. In other words, after pursuing an austerity program of sorts for 20 years to no avail, the Japanese have decided to undertake the most aggressive anti-austerity moves from a central monetary authority probably in history. And it's going to be very, very interesting to see what the effects are. If suddenly Japan gets rolling again, what will the Europeans do then? Because they've already been left in the dust by the American. Yeah, I mean, you know, American unemployment is not what any of us would like. But it's dropped from 12% to 7.6%. In Europe, it's going up still. Mm-hmm. It's going up now in Germany as well. And they're really scratching their heads. They're really, really, really worried. And now if you have the joint examples of America's on and off again anti-austerity policies. In fact, the sum total of the policy has been far, far less austere than it has been in Europe, with an extremely aggressive step against austerity in Japan, mm-hmm. and it works for both of them. It's going to be the Europeans can't continue sitting on their hands. They're going to have, and you have to also look at the fact that Obama, in one of the more well-thought-out initiatives of his second term, has proposed establishing a kind of common market with the EU, a version of NAFTA that would drop all barriers between Europe, the European Union, and the United States in terms of trade. You know, there's so much more activity right now in terms of new policy ideas than there was just a year and a half ago, that I think there's reason to take heart.
Frank, I want to turn to the flashpoints in the Middle East, the hot war in Syria, the recent visit that you alluded to by President Obama to Israel. And to me, the big takeaway was the last few minutes before he left Ben-Gurion Airport, where he somehow twisted Netanyahu's arm into making the phone call to Erdogan in Turkey and offering a formal apology for the attack on the Mavi Marmara. And Erdogan appears to be playing this pretty tough himself. The new Secretary of State, John Kerry, in Istanbul over this past weekend, is trying to get Turkey to restore full diplomatic relations. And Erdogan is holding out for a lifting of the commercial sanctions, the commercial barriers, to the Palestinians. And I support that move. I think it could go a long way toward removing some of the angst there between Israel and the Palestinians. How do you see this playing out, and do you think that the president's visit was a net positive?
Oh, yes. It was a net positive on several levels, one of which was the response of Israeli young people to Obama. I don't know if you read the... there was a compendium of about a dozen or so brief interviews with young Israelis who had been at the... speech that Obama gave, mm-hmm. a kind of town hall meeting in which he was very out front about insisting that for once they tried and imagine what life would be like if they were Palestinians in that part of the world and not Israelis. And it was extraordinary and coincided with my own impression. I've spent a lot of time in Israel over the years, and I was pretty shocked. The last time I was there a few years ago, I interviewed quite a few young people. I made it a point to interview a large number of young people. And to a person, they admitted to me they were trying to think of a way to leave. Hmm. And, you know, Netanyahu has been so faithful to people he doesn't agree with, by the way. Netanyahu is a secularist. He's been so faithful to the ultra-conservative religious forces in Israel that he hasn't paid any attention to the larger constituency. Israel can't afford to lose its young, bright people. It's a nation that turns out a disproportionate number of very bright IT people, for example. Silicon Valley and Google and places like that are full of young Israelis now. So there's a great deal of pressure within Israeli society, much more than it sometimes seems from the outside, for productive change rather than stasis. Stasis is dangerous for everybody. And stasis, when it comes to the Palestinian, is far worse, of course, because they're basically told that they don't even have the right to make a decent living. I mean, how are they going to survive? This, in a larger context of the Middle East, of course, has to be viewed against the rising instability of all of the neighboring countries, and on a more positive level, the extraordinary prosperity and level of development in Turkey. Americans on the issue of Turkey are sort of divided in two, those who've been there in recent years and those who haven't. Those who haven't think it's a country of Midnight Express. Turkey, in its advances in economic terms in the last two decades, is every bit as impressive as China. It's extraordinary, and it's far more democratic than China. Turkey's the only bridge to the Islamic world for the West. It's the only functional bridge because it has a dual identity as a very, very self-starting, work-oriented, secular society that has accomplished enormous, enormous achievements over the past decade or so. But it's also overwhelmingly Islamic. It can speak both languages. And that bridge is just as necessary to Netanyahu, who presides over a small non-Islamic island in an Islamic sea, and to Western Europe. The Europeans are crazy to continue. Every time Turkey nears approval for full admission to the European Union, they come up with some reason to turn them down. And the reasons are never very convincing. And the Turks themselves are beginning to lose interest.
Now, let me link this, though, to the civil war in Syria, now 2 years plus, over 70,000 people killed. And fundamentally, the thing I see is the rising tide of Kurdish nationalism, the desire to create some sort of a Kurdistan or Kurdish state with parts of Syria, Iraq, and Turkey. And it seems to me that no matter what happens in the end game of Syria, that that is going to be a continuing problem for the leaders of Turkey, who are really a very hard line in their suppression of the Kurds.
Well, actually, the current government, in its first 2 years in power, made much, much more important gestures toward the Kurds than any of its predecessors.
And we do have a ceasefire or a stand down.
We do
that
now,
was recently ordered.
Öcalan, mm-hmm. the head of the Kurds, who's been in prison now for I've forgotten how many years, has publicly called for his military forces to withdraw. And it was actually a unilateral ceasefire on his part, and serious negotiations are underway. There's been actually pretty great progress there. But I think the most important progress is, again, something you only understand if you've been there on the ground. I've spent a great deal of time in the Kurdish parts of Turkey and also in Iraqi Kurdistan. And they've become part of the modern world. There's the overall prosperity of Turkey has affected them in a visible and important way. And I think that one reason for the new accommodation on the part of Öcalan is the recognition that his own people now would probably be more satisfied with full cultural autonomy within a larger Turkey than they would, God knows they don't want to be part of a larger Kurdistan that includes the Iranian part of Kurdistan mm-hmm. or the Syrian part of Kurdistan. Iraqi Kurdistan is interesting as a laboratory because it is, to all intents and purposes, fully autonomous now. It has so little to do with the rest of Iraq as to be independent. And one of the chief reasons for its prosperity is that it has developed extremely strong economic ties to Turkey.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that there's far more promise in terms of the Kurdish question than there has been in a very, very long time. And for this reason, among many, many other reasons, Ankara is deeply, deeply concerned about the instability and violence in Syria because it throws a wrench into many works and not just one.
Mm-hmm.
The question, if you carry it further to the other side of the Mediterranean, is whether the danger to Israel of not only escalating violence in Turkey and a breakdown in all of the fundamental understandings, is that a greater threat to them or is it a benefit to them because the government currently in power might see itself as benefiting from instability in Syria and Lebanon, obviously, and you know, that's a little more difficult to assess.
Mm-hmm.
I think probably they see it both ways.
Frank, there's lots to talk about. I wish we could go for another hour or so. But let me wrap up with a question about North Africa. And it starts with the takedown of Gaddafi in Libya. And now we have French forces in Mali. The U.S. AFRICOM is getting more muscular. We've got now a drone base in Djibouti, I believe. And so the militarization of the sub-Sahara or the Saharan region there, in broad terms, is of concern. And we saw last fall a lot of hot air blasted about Benghazi. And while I believe the Obama administration handled that badly, I don't see it as an issue of bad faith. But the question that was never raised in all of the controversy over Benghazi is whether we should have taken out Gaddafi to begin with. Is there any second guessing in Europe about the wisdom of the changeover in Libya?
No, I think they've forgotten about it.
Already.
Because now they're so concerned about Mali at the moment. Libya has really been pushed to the back burner.
Mm-hmm.
The Maghreb, the northern Arab part of Africa, was a much dicier issue for the French, particularly 10 years ago, than it is today. Most of the home-based extremism in France was coming from Algeria, and to a somewhat lesser extent from Morocco. And that's a great deal quieter now than it has been. So they don't really care much about Libya now.
And what about Mali? Is there a concern about the French presence there, and will they be able to withdraw as quickly as President Hollande has asserted?
Hollande's popularity is the lowest in the history of the Fifth French Republic. No president has had lower popularity ratings less than a year after his election. And there is simply no taste in the Western democracies right now, after Iraq, after Afghanistan, for military involvement. When he first went in, it made him seem a bit macho, and his ratings went up briefly. Then they started to dive. And I don't think the French want their soldiers there. Now, mm-hmm. The French, they do have the fallback position of using the Foreign Legion. And I think they'll probably keep some sort of Foreign Legion force there for a while. But they've always been present there. I mean, one of the paradoxes of France's anti-imperialist state is that it's, in some respects, the last real true European imperialist nation. They have bases all over the world. They have départements, which are the equivalent of U.S. states, all over the world. Mm-hmm. And they've had very substantial military forces present in almost all of the former, in the Francophone West African nations ever since independence. So this is nothing new. But we never
hear about French imperialism.
No. It's France exporting its version of democracy.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Frank, it's really great to see you. Thanks for sharing your views with my listeners today. Frank Viviano,
a
journalist,
pleasure, Peter.
Now based in Italy.
All the world over, so easy to see. People everywhere just wanna be free. Listen, people, listen, that's the way it should be. Deep in the valley, people got to be free.
We continue on the Peter B. Collins Show. And Jeff Halper returns to our program today. It's about 2 years ago. I talked with him at the Sabeel Conference here in the Bay Area. He is an American from Minnesota, if I have the story right. Moved to Israel how long ago, Jeff?
40 years.
40 years ago. Holy cow.
Mm-hmm.
And when did you found the Israeli Committee Against House Demolitions?
It was in 1997,
mm-hmm.
about 16 years ago.
Okay. And what did you do in Israel before you became this kind of activist?
I'm an anthropologist. So I did my research for my doctorate on the Kurdish Jews from Kurdistan who came to live mm-hmm. in Israel. And from there I got into, I wrote a book about the Jewish community in Jerusalem in the 19th century, which was interesting. I was very active with the Ethiopian Jewish community. I did research in Ethiopia in the 60s. I was active with them. But I was always active, and then I taught at the university, at Ben-Gurion University in particular.
Mm-hmm.
But I've always been political,
yeah.
You know, coming out of the 60s.
Mm-hmm.
So from the very beginning, I was involved with the Israeli peace movement. It wasn't a story of someone who came as a Zionist and got disillusioned and found his way to the left. I started on the left. When I came to Israel, I knew there was occupation. I knew I was simply going, in my view, to another front in the revolution.
Mm-hmm. And from the American perspective, at least as a progressive, I kind of reflexively view the problem as Israeli expansionism, the settlements that continue to be built on Palestinian land.
Right.
But you focus on the demolition of Palestinian homes.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me a little bit about that. And are they two sides of the same coin? Or do you view the displacement of Palestinians as a kind of greater evil?
No, it's certainly part of the greater evil. In other words, Zionism comes out of Eastern and Central Europe, the end of the 19th century, end of the 20th century. And that kind of nationalism is very different. You know, Israel tries to present itself as a Western democracy.
Right.
But it really isn't. It's very different. It's much more like Russia or Poland or even Germany before the end of World War II. In other words, it comes from the idea that a country belongs not to its citizens, but to one particular group. Russia belongs to the Russians. So the Jews lived for 1,000 years in Russia and were never considered Russians because Russian is kind of a tribe. Poland belongs to the Poles. Germany belonged to the Germans. And even though Jews tried desperately to become German, they couldn't do it. And that was the kind of nationalism that they brought into Palestine. And so Israel is really what we call an ethnocracy. An ethnocracy are countries like those that belong to one particular group, not to all the people that live in the country.
Mm-hmm.
And so the problem with ethnocracy is that it has an exclusive claim. So when the Zionists came into Palestine, they didn't say, we want to come home, we see this as our homeland, we want to revive our national culture and so on, but we recognize and acknowledge that there's also another people here. And now let's see how we can work things out. Instead, they came into the idea that this is our country exclusively. It belongs exclusively to the Jewish people. There is no other people here. No one else has any rights except us. I mean, there's a bunch of Arabs. We can see that.
Mm-hmm.
But they don't add up to a collective, to a nation, to a people that have national rights. And therefore, and that set off this destructive dynamic that we have until today. And that is that Israel can't make peace with the Palestinians. Structurally, because the very conception is that there's only one people in this country. This country is the land of Israel. It belongs to the Jews. And we can't even use the word Palestinian because that gives too much recognition to another collective that we don't want to admit exists.
Mm-hmm.
So the whole thrust then of Zionism and Israeli policy is towards displacing the Palestinians completely from the country, or at least locking them into little kind of ghettoized areas, and then replacing Palestine with the land of Israel, changing the place names, changing the entire landscape so that there is no more. Palestine is erased. The Palestinian culture, the Palestinian people, the very concept of Palestine, and it becomes Israel.
So are Palestinians the eighth plague?
The Palestinians aren't really a plague. In other words, it's a self-contained thing. It wasn't against Palestinians. I don't think the Jews coming from Minsk and Pinsk and wherever they came from knew of Palestinians or Arabs.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this is at a time, when the world was much bigger than it is today, and they didn't know. But simply, I think, from the internal logic of Zionism, it didn't matter if they had encountered the Native Americans or they'd encountered anybody else, that it would have been the same issue. And that is, how do we reclaim, that's the biblical term, how do we reclaim or redeem the land of Israel from these intruders? And who the intruders are doesn't really matter.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't an anti-Arab thing or anti-Muslim. It was simply sort of anti-whoever took over our country in the 2,000 years when we were gone.
Mm-hmm.
And now we have to take it back.
Now, last time we spoke, we spent some amount of time talking about Israel as a theocracy, more than an ethnocracy. And I was persuaded by that, and I see it as a highly militarized theocracy, where it's really, you know, the profiling is based on your cultural and religious values.
Right. Well, I mean, theocracy is a part of it. You know, certainly a part of the exclusive claim to the country comes from the Bible. God gave us that land. So, you know, if you're religious, I mean, that certainly is a theocratic basis. And there are strong forces in Israel, religious parties, that are trying to turn Israel into a religious state. And in fact, according to the last polls, the majority of Israeli Jews are religious. I mean, not extreme necessarily, but religious. So that's certainly a part of it. But it's wider than ethnocracy. I mean, Zionism itself was a secular movement. In fact, Zionism was very anti-religious. It was a secular national movement. So in a sense, there's a dovetailing, because what I said about ethnocracy, the claim, exclusive claim to the country, because it belongs to us, rests partly on the biblical narrative that comes out of a religious reading. But if you, you can also look at the Bible as a historical book. So people like Begin, or even Ben-Gurion, or Sharon, you know, the ultra-nationalists weren't religious. But instead, they looked at the Bible as a historic. So they wouldn't say God gave us the land. They would say this is where the Jewish people were born. This is where our civilization began, and therefore it belongs. You get to the same place without being a theocracy. You, and so ethnocracy is sort of the wider, and I think more accurate term.
We're talking with Jeff Halper here on the Peter B. Collins Show. And Jeff, in the preceding segment, journalist Frank Viviano was commenting on his view of President Obama's visit in March to Israel, his first since he became president. And I'd like to hear your thoughts about it. What do you think was achieved? And a year or 5 years from now, will anything be credited to his state visit?
I mean, I have no thoughts about it. I don't think any
Israeli we'll move
has
on
a
then.
Thought.
Great.
No, no, simply from the point of view of that it was a non-event. I mean, you know, somebody said, you know, he's coming as a tourist. I mean, in a sense, that's what Obama was saying. I have no plan. I have no message. I mean, I'm willing to kind of meet, you know. And he even tried to minimize his official meetings. You know, he didn't speak in the Knesset and the parliament. He, I mean, he had to kind of meet Abu Mazen and Netanyahu and do this and that. But basically, he was a tourist. And, you know, he did speak to a very selected, vetted group of students. But essentially, it was a non-event, I think. And what it gets to is even something deeper than the Israel-Palestine issue. And I think this is something that we have to understand. And that is that governments don't resolve conflicts. Governments manage conflicts. So the way Israel gets away with what it's getting away with, violations of international law, violations of human rights, an occupation that's perpetuating the conflict, the elimination of the two-state solution by the settlements, the violence, the settler violence, I mean, as outrageous as the Israeli behavior and policy and occupation is, it has nothing to fear from the United States or Europe, because human rights and international law and justice and peace are not the basis of policies of governments. As long as, I think the message to Israel is, as long as you can keep the lid on, with the help of Abu Mazen and the Palestinian Authority, who are like the collaborators, the you know, the agents of Israel in a sense, the policemen of Israel, as long as you all can keep the lid on, and everything is quiet, and this conflict doesn't disrupt the international system. There's no third intifada. It doesn't, you know, Hamas doesn't all of a sudden link up to Al-Qaeda. As long as everything is localized and fairly quiet, we can live with it. I mean, here and there you'll expect, I think this is probably what he told Netanyahu, here and there expect us to criticize you. You know, it's, we have to give some lip service to human rights. But don't take it seriously. We're not going to sanction you. We're not going to stop you in any way. And but you have to know that our tacit support for your policies are dependent on you keeping the lid on.
Mm-hmm.
It's another game. If this whole thing blows up, and, you know, we already have five or six wars in the Middle East, and you know, we want to get on to other issues. We want to move our fleet to Asia. We have other parts of the world that are a little more urgent. So as long as you serve our purposes and keep everything quiet, or fairly under control, it's fine. Don't worry about it. And I think that was actually the message, because the whole idea that somehow Obama went, you know, goes to the Middle East in order to solve a problem, the whole common sense idea that we all have is that there's a problem and therefore governments care and will do something to resolve it is wrong. The governments deal with conflict management, not with conflict resolution. They take the path of least resistance. And again, as long as it's quiet, I don't care Ireland, Norway, Sweden, I don't care how committed to human rights a country is. If it's quiet, they can live very well with apartheid. They can live very well with occupation, with oppression. It does not bother them as long as it's quietized.
Now, in the U.S., the speech before what you described as a carefully selected group of students, kind That's of a right. George W. Bush town hall meeting,
That's right.
Was played up. And there were some lines in the president's speech where he challenged Israelis to think what it's like to be a Palestinian,
yeah.
and where he made a comment that I've heard echoed by Palestinians who I've talked to, that Israel can't have peace until there is peace for the Palestinians. And yeah, I'm paraphrasing. Yeah. So how did that play in Israel? Was it widely broadcast? And what was the reaction?
No, it wasn't widely broadcast. I mean, in other words, he was on TV and so on. But it was ephemeral.
Mm-hmm.
It went.
So it was just a soundbite.
It was just absolutely a soundbite. And mm-hmm. even the students there, who were more liberal students, you know, they were very carefully vetted, didn't really comment on it. I mean, the whole thing was there. They heard Obama for 10 minutes and went home.
Mm.
I mean, there was no. You know, there was no meaning to it. It was very generalized. I don't think he was really challenging the Israeli public in any way. And it's true. I mean, it would be very nice if there was peace. But it's really not that important. Otherwise, he would have been there with a more structured kind of a program.
Mm-hmm.
So now, I think the whole thing was simply a soundbite.
And what do you make of the final scene before he climbed onto Air Force One at Ben Gurion mm-hmm. Airport,
mm-hmm.
where he presumably twisted Netanyahu's arm?
Yeah.
Because after resistance from the prime minister, Bibi agreed to pick up the phone,
yeah.
and Obama intermediated an mm-hmm. apology from Israel to Turkey right. to Prime Minister Erdogan.
Yeah, I think that was, it's hard to know whether that was spontaneous or planned or whatever. If he sprung it on Netanyahu or Netanyahu afterwards said it was planned. It wasn't, you know, I don't know if he was defending himself.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, it's important to the United States. The two bookends of American support in the area and that bookend Israel are Egypt on the one side and Turkey on the other side.
Mm-hmm.
And the United States has very important military bases in Turkey, and you have NATO issues. I mean, Israel is in the NATO neighborhood, it's called. It's like an associate member of NATO, and Turkey is in NATO. So, you know, you can't have NATO allies in that part of the world when you're looking at Iran and you're looking at what's happening in Syria. You know, it doesn't really serve things if they're at each other.
Mm-hmm.
So in a sense, it was a little bit of some fence mending. And,
but one of the things
wasn't
that
really much more significant than that.
I often try to think critically and look at things and say, okay, in this picture, what's missing?
Mm-hmm.
Because the apology was from Israel to Turkey.
Right.
The Gaza flotillas are an attempt to break the Israeli sea blockade of Gaza.
Right.
I didn't hear any apology to the people of Gaza. And in fact, the Americans who orchestrated the Freedom Flotillas, and there were many, also didn't get an apology. It was the inconvenient loss of life from the Israeli commando raid on an unarmed ship in international waters.
That's right.
And all of those factors were not included in any description of this historic apology from Israel to Turkey.
Turkey also omitted one condition. Turkey said we'll make up with Israel, one, if Israel apologizes, two, if Israel pays compensation to the Turkish victims, and three, that it ends its blockade of Egypt, of Gaza. That was the that was the third, and that completely disappeared.
Now, as we're speaking in the second week of April, John Kerry, the new Secretary of State, visited Istanbul in the last few days and is urging the Turkish government to open up full diplomatic relations with Israel.
Yeah.
And Erdogan, to his credit, appears to be holding out, saying that third element that you just described is critical to him. And he at least has a planned or scheduled visit to the Gaza Strip in the next few weeks.
That's right.
So tell me what your thoughts are. Will Turkey be able to produce some relief for the Palestinians that the U.S. hasn't even asked for?
Well, you know, it's very interesting because Turkey's not an Arab country. I mean, the Arab countries have always let down the Palestinians. Turkey, I think, you know, could play a role, except that it's not a central player. I mean, it's an important player in the wider Middle East. I don't think it's a central player in terms of the Palestinian issue. And there's a certain amount of symbolic support it can give to the Palestinians and so on, but I don't think it can really go beyond that too much. And the other, of course, thing is that a lot of this is lip service. I mean, the Turks have very, very deep military relations with Israel. I mean, half their air force is serviced by Israel. And there's key strategic issues that are in common. I think what bothers Turkey more, in a sense, is that after the fight with Turkey, Israel got closer to Greece. I mean, Israel's also been playing with different buttons. So, I think the Palestinians are not a very important variable in this whole thing. Mm-hmm. One other thing I just want to mention is that, you know, I was on the first boat to Gaza.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I was.
I didn't know that.
I was a part of the Free Gaza movement. The first boat went in 2008, and we actually got in August 2008. And the whole concept of it was that we're breaking the siege of Gaza. This is not humanitarian. We brought a few hearing aids for kids because with the sonic booms that Israel does constantly over Gaza to punish the population, children there have started to lose their hearing. So, you don't come as a guest empty-handed.
Yeah.
But that wasn't the point was political. And what happened with with this larger flotilla, and this is where I didn't really like it very much, with the Mavi Marmara, is that it was a humanitarian effort. They came with tons of cement and medicines and all that. And I think to some degree the Free Gaza movement that was supposed to be in charge of the whole thing simply got overwhelmed, these few activists, by this huge ship and the organizations and the money behind it.
And the Turkish, the nonprofit, HMS or something, I never knew who they were and whether that was a legitimate participant.
Yeah, and there's criticism that they're in touch with Islamic radical groups and so on. That didn't really bother me as much as the fact that they advertised it, and the whole thing came out as a humanitarian gesture, that they're bringing all this stuff to Gaza, so that in a sense it lost the political thing. And so in a way, it's true that the government of Turkey today has a little bit brought back the political. I mean, they brought back the idea that Gaza is still under siege. But there's something interesting here as well if you look at the wider Middle East, and that is that in 2002 the Arab League unanimously presented to Israel what it called the Arab Peace Initiative. Which said that if you, Israel, give up the occupied territories, we'll not only recognize you and make peace with you, we'll integrate you into the region. And Israel rejected that in the beginning. But I think Sharon, just before he when it was Coma, began to reconsider. I think that was part of the background of the disengagement from Gaza, because what the Arab world was really saying was that we want you to be the Israel. We want you to be the regional hegemon. You've got the army. You've got the connections to the United States. And we have absolutely the same foreign interests. We're against Iran. We're afraid of Iran. We're afraid of terrorism. All these conservative Arab regimes, if you take away the Palestinian issue, have almost exactly the same interests as the United States. And so, as Israel. And so, in a sense, they were saying, look, you can't be the regional hegemon. We can't really normalize with you as long as you have an occupation, because we have a street and we have people and we can't do that. So get rid of this damn occupation, and then we can normalize and you can be the hegemon. I think Turkey, in a sense, is a part of that. I think Turkey really values the Israeli military prowess. Turkey and Israel, I think, have some very similar foreign policy and regional interests, but what they're all saying to Israel, I think the subtext is not only end the blockade of Gaza, get rid of this occupation so that we can normalize and get in, because all these conservative regimes, they don't want Arab Springs and Arab uprisings, and the Palestinians for them are a danger.
Mm-hmm.
Palestinians, in a sense, are this disruptive factor that they don't like. They represent, they put in the face of the world occupation, oppression, human rights. And that's not the face of the Middle East that these conservative regimes want. So I think, in a way, resolving the Palestinian issue on the part of Turkey isn't necessarily because of the Palestinians. It's in order to go back to this world, this order in the Middle East, where Israel plays a key role, but only if it ends this occupation.
Now, Jeff, the 2002 Arab Peace Plan, and forgive me because there was a later one fronted by the Saudis, but
no, that was the peace plan.
Oh, it's the same one? Yeah. Didn't they call, though, for a nuclear-free zone? And isn't that kind of the poison pill from Israel's point of view?
No, that was there were other things as well, but that wasn't a part of the what was called the Arab, or sometimes it was called the Saudi Peace Initiative. No, that wasn't a part of it.
Okay. Then, speaking of nukes, the whole focus of American policy vis-a-vis Israel is on the Israeli demand for a preemptive strike on Iran.
Mm-hmm.
I consider it sheer madness to add another military operation or front to a part of the world where we already have continuing violence in Iraq, a hot war in Syria, and the unrest that comes from the so-called Arab Spring. So please tell me how this plays in Israel, because it's hard to imagine that an attack on Iran wouldn't produce significant retaliation and put hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of Israelis in extreme risk. All over this faulty premise that, quote unquote, Iran cannot be permitted to develop a nuclear weapon like Israel has.
Right. Look, first of all, it's a non-issue in Israel, because Ehud Barak, when he was defense minister, said it openly about a year ago. Iran does not have nuclear weapons, isn't intending to have nuclear weapons, and poses no existential threat to Israel. So from that point of view, there's no issue here.
Can somebody tell AIPAC?
And I mean, you can look it up. This is what Barak said. Secondly, Barak also said, if Iran does attack us or counterattack us Israel, we'll lose maybe 800 people. That's it, because Israel has these new systems they're developing, the Arrow system, which is a system to intercept intercontinental missiles, the Iron Dome, that's a shorter missile system.
Obama had to go genuflect before an Iron Dome when he arrived in Israel. I saw that.
Or the other way around, the Iron Dome genuflect, because they brought the Iron Dome from the south of the country to the airport.
Okay.
So he could have that photo op.
Uh-huh.
So in other words, you know, from the Israeli point of view, Iran can't really touch Israel. It can attack, and we'll lose maybe 100 people, which for, you know, from in the military thinking,
acceptable,
that's acceptable
losses.
And, yeah. You know, it's not a big deal. And therefore, Israel, the Israelis feel defended, or they feel secure.
Mm-hmm.
So in a sense, there's a disconnect between it. In other words, it isn't really coming because of Israeli fears. I think this whole Iran issue is the ultimate deflection from the Palestinian issue. You have to understand that what really preoccupies the Israeli government is, how do we normalize the Palestinian issue? How do we get it off the agenda? And in my view, at least, I could be wrong, you know, there's no point in Israel attacking Iran now, or even leading to that kind of an attack, because everything's quiet on the Palestinian front. But if Israel would feel, if the Palestinians start going to the International Criminal Court, the Palestinians really start pushing the vote that was last November in the UN. If, in fact, they do, and they're not going to do this, but if they did create a certain momentum and Israel begins to feel pressure and its back's to the wall, then it would make sense to attack Iran, because it's completely extraneous to Israel. In other words, it's the ultimate deflection.
Mm-hmm.
And once you attack Iran, I mean, you're not going to hear the word Palestinian for the next 10 years. I mean, it's going to throw the whole area into chaos.
Mm-hmm.
And Israel, of course, has no compunction about getting the Americans involved. So the Americans, in some ways, are not, I mean, this is a stupid thing that's always, we're always saying that the Americans are not acting according to their own national interests. They're being pushed and dragged and pulled somehow by Israel and Israeli supporters into actions and campaigns and things that really don't serve American interests at all. But Israel is willing to sacrifice the United States in order to deflect attention from its own occupation. Americans shouldn't think that Israel is really its ally. Israel is willing to sacrifice the United States. You know, Israel is the number two arms supplier to China. China, from the Pentagon's point of view, is the enemy. I mean, they're moving the fleets to Asia. China, they're trying to contain China. And here Israel, who's supposedly America's valued ally in the Middle East, is the number two arms exporter and supplier to China. Israel would switch sides in a minute. The minute the Chinese advantage ups the American advantage in some way, they have no loyalty to the United States. I mean, this whole thing of we have share common values and we're allies and we're friends forever, like Obama said, eternal allies, that might be his view. It's not the Israeli view.
Wow, that is telling. So is Israel testing the United States to see if we love it enough through these challenges to get tougher on Iran?
No, I think simply Israel is able to use United States as a way of deflecting attention. What Israel wants to do is normalize the it feels that, all right, we've completed our occupation. We have the settlements. We've got everything. We've eliminated the two-state solution. The Palestinians have been pacified. Now we have to get the world to begin to move on to other issues. The Palestinian issue has been too central. And in fact, what's really helping the Palestinians, and what's, you know, that's where I'm coming from, is that the only agent that really is keeping the Palestinian issue on the map is civil society. Are the people here, the people listening to your program, a lot of them, I'm sure, you know, the Palestinian issue has become, I think, one of the two or three major world issues. I think it's assumed the dimensions of the anti-apartheid struggle.
Mm-hmm.
That's what's keeping it on the map. Otherwise, it's gone. Palestinians aren't disrupting anything. And if we can get, the Israelis can get the Americans to begin to focus on Iran, and the world to focus on Iran, and the Palestinians get lost in the dust, that's a major diplomatic achievement.
Then does Israel, and I'm really referring to the leaders of the government, do they ever consider that lightening the subjugation of the Palestinian people is in their self-interest?
Yes.
Because that's what would ultimately normalize
and
defuse the thing that is linked to so many different conflicts.
That's right. I think we're in that process. You know, first we have to break the Palestinians, break their will to resist. You know, despair is really a part of the Israeli policy towards the Palestinians, to get them to despair of ever having a state in Palestine.
Mm-hmm.
And again, to let them feel that they've been abandoned by the larger powers, Europe and America are not going to be on their side, and so on. And then, at that stage, which we haven't quite gotten to yet, then Israel can begin to lighten up on the Palestinians. And in fact, you know, Israel is the main supporter of the Palestinian Authority. I mean, so on the one hand, Israel punishes the Palestinian Authority by withholding tax monies and by attacking and by humiliating and everything else. But on the other hand, it's very careful not to cross a red line in which it really endangers the existence of the Palestinian Authority.
Because that's important to its divide and conquer strategy.
That's right.
Right?
I mean, Israel doesn't want to... Israel wants the land, but it doesn't want the Palestinians. It needs mm-hmm. the fiction. And this is what the two-state fiction is based on. It needs the fiction that there's another side, negotiations are going on, and to keep that going as long as possible. But it certainly doesn't really want to make peace with the Palestinians.
Mm-hmm.
That's my phone.
That's all right. We got it. So what do you see as the path forward, Jeff Halper? Is there still a possibility of a two-state solution, or have we lost that potential and we're looking at different ways for a one-state solution where the Palestinians would become full citizens of Israel?
Well, I think the two-state solution is gone. I think that's clear. But it doesn't mean that the one-state solution is the default. And that's, we're really kind of stuck today. I think the Palestinians are stuck. Because on the one hand, I mean, they can see the two-state solution is gone. The idea that somehow there'll be a Palestinian state in occupied territories is ridiculous. And people see that. On the other hand, there's what's called, you know, Gramsci talked about the optimism of the will and the pessimism of the intellect. And that's where the Palestinians are, because on the one hand, they see that the two-state solution is gone, but they can't really give it up, because they're involved for 100 years in a movement, a struggle for national liberation. And their only hope of getting something national, some modicum of self-determination, is at least a little Palestinian state. Once they abandon that, if they abandon the two-state, where are they?
Mm-hmm.
Now they're looking at a one-state solution. They're locked forever into a state with their oppressors. The Israelis are stronger in many ways, institutionally, educationally, politically. And, you know, they're liable to become an underclass.
Mm-hmm.
And now they also got to start thinking, oh, God, now it took us 50 years to get the two-state solution accepted. We got to start all over again now. You know, and now we've got to convince the world that if there's one state, the Israeli Jews will be fine and they'll be secure and we'll be nice to them. And starting all that stuff again and then trying to... They just don't have, I think, the mental and emotional energy to do that now. So I think... And then, of course, the question is what kind of one-state solution? Because my view of a one-state solution that I just wrote about is binational. I think, you know, whether it should be so or not, Israel is, Israelis are a national group. They're not just an ethnic group, or they're not just Jews. They're Israelis. And you have two peoples living in that country. So I think it has to be binational. But a lot of Palestinians really aren't there. They mm-hmm. say no, because Israel is a settler colonial state. It has no legitimacy. So Jews can live in the country, but only as Jews, not as Israelis. Mm-hmm. And it becomes a mirror opposite of what Israel's always been saying about the Palestinians. So we have a long way to go, a lot of thought, and that's the problem. We're in an urgent conflict, which is a lot of suffering. It's having tremendous, I think, impact on the global system that doesn't have a ready, apparent solution. And in some ways, this is the challenge to the Palestinians. It's the Palestinians' call. I'm not Palestinian. You're not Palestinian. We can't tell them what the solution is. So in a sense, we have to sort of wait on them, and hopefully this discussion is taking place among them, to begin to shift. If the two-state solution is gone, where are we going? Because to be in a political struggle in which you have no end game, you have nothing to advocate for, is a very dangerous place to be, and it doesn't lead you anywhere.
And similarly, we have a situation in Syria where there doesn't appear to be any happy potential outcome, because the Assad government, now labeled a regime, of course, by the U.S. State Department, is a brutal dictatorship that has really wrecked that country, both in human and physical terms. And yet the end game, after a presumed departure by Assad under whatever circumstances, is pretty hard to predict. But nobody expects it to become a democracy.
That's right.
Or even a society that promotes pluralism and any kind of citizen participation.
That's right.
So how do you see that playing out?
I don't know. But...
because we know that anybody who says they do know doesn't know what they're talking about.
But what I am involved in, and it's very hard because we can't really talk to Syrians. We can't really talk to Egyptians or to, you know, as Israelis. I mean, they don't talk, the civil society, I mean. But I think that there's a real issue here. They just had the World Social Forum in Tunis. There was a World Social Forum in November in Brazil on the issue of Palestine. I think what has to happen somehow, because like I said, the governments are going to divide us. The governments are going to try to maintain the status quo. They're not going to try to resolve things. And it's up to the people to do that. So I would like to see a situation that I'm trying to work towards, but it's very difficult, in which we're in touch with each other, the Israeli civil society, especially the progressives, the Palestinian progressives, but Syrian progressives and Turkish progressives and Lebanese and in different... In other words, the people can't replicate the enmities that the governments have created. Hmm. And we have to be critical of each other. It's not, I'm not saying we hold hands and we're all friends. I mean, there's very hard discussions that have to take place. But at some point, if we don't come together... to begin to forge the kind of societies we want, nobody else is going to do it. I mean, you've got political factions, religious factions, governments that have more power than we do. They have ideologies, they have weapons, and they'll do it if we don't. So somehow there's got to be a mechanism that does not exist today in which we start to, I mean, the last thing, for example, a Syrian human rights organization can do is talk to an Israeli. I mean, immediately they'd be labeled Zionist and everything else. So there's some real structural obstacles to that. But that's my thought of how do we get out of this. I really take the idea of people power seriously. And we have to try to overcome those barriers. And we have to be the ones to forge the way ahead and not rely on governments or factions to do that.
Jeff Halper is the founder and executive director of the Israeli Committee Against House Demolitions. You can visit the website at icahd.org, and I'll put up a link in the show file at peterbcollins.com. And there's a tab there that can give you the information on his current U.S. tour. I'll just mention a few of your stops in the next few days. Thursday, April 11th at City College of San Francisco. And then also that afternoon at the University of California, Berkeley in Wheeler Hall with a 7 p.m. reception. Also Friday, April 12th at Christ the King Church in Pleasant Hill, California. And then my friend Tom McAfee is going to interview you at the Hot Activist First Presbyterian Church of San Anselmo, and that's on Saturday, April 13th. And then you'll be in Santa Cruz Sunday, April 14th at the Resource Center for Nonviolence. And take a moment to tell us about some of the programs of ICAHD. You say ICAD.
ICAD, right.
Yeah. You allow Americans to come to Israel to do reconstruction projects, is that right? A summer camp?
We took the issue of house demolitions as our vehicle for resisting the occupation. Israel's demolished 28,000 Palestinian homes in the occupied territory since 1967. So we resist demolitions, but we also rebuild homes. We've built 186 homes over the last 12, 13 years as political acts of resistance, not humanitarian gestures, as political acts together with Palestinians. And every summer we have a camp where we rebuild one or two or more Palestinian homes. We also build during the year, but the main camp is during the summer, where people come from all over the world to join us. And so if people are interested, they should just go to our website, which is www.icad.org.
Mm-hmm. And you also offer specially guided tours of Jerusalem and other areas?
And in the occupied territories.
Mm-hmm.
We have our group in the UK has two two-week tours of the occupied territories and Israel as well, in a very political sense, twice a year. You know, twice a year they do that. And if they look up ICADUK.org, they can get that information. But if people come to the country, or if you have a student group or an activist group or a delegation and you're coming, we give very good tours, very critical tours of Jerusalem, the West Bank. And again, you can look it up on our website. So yeah, we're really, I think, a very important base to touch when you come, because we're critical. We have good materials. We have very good tours, great relations with our Palestinian partners. And, we can really help you to get oriented and to begin to understand the issues.
Jeff Halper, great to see you again. Thanks for stopping by today.
Thanks for having me on.
I'm interested in your comments. Drop me an email, humblehost@peterbcollins.com. Or should you disagree, fullofit@peterbcollins.com.
Trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling.